You're listening to episode 14 of season 7 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is the GNU World Order Augcast, in which we discuss GNU, the world, and the order. Also, we'll be talking about the Indiana Linux Fest today, where I'm actually recording this very episode. I'm in a hotel room right now, and it's a really nice hotel room. Quite a luxury lately, since I don't really have a place to live for the past year, so this is quite nice. And there's a coffee machine in the hotel room, which is a very nice feature, I think. The Linux Fest is going quite well, I'd say. This is the second year of the Indiana Linux Fest, and I have to say that I'm just really impressed with it. I don't feel like it got spammed all over all the podcasts, like it wasn't really talked about ad infinitum or anything, or ad nauseum, I guess. But it's just a really nice little festival. It feels like it might be possibly in a way smaller in scale than last year's version of the Indiana Linux Fest, and I don't mean that in a negative or a bad way at all. I actually kind of like it. Don't get me wrong, I really like convention where you get the free shirt, and you get the nice program guides, and you get a bag full of stuff, and it's really exciting, and you're happy, and it feels like a real convention. But I also feel like that's forcing a certain thing on the expectations of what a convention should be, and I don't feel like that expectation is necessarily correct or fair. I think there's a lot of strength in having a small-ish fest. I'm not saying that this fest is sparsely attended by any means. It seems to be doing really well. But I am just saying that there's a feeling of it just being on a smaller scale, because maybe the organizers might not have, maybe they didn't shoot quite as high as another fest might. So they're not doing the t-shirts this year. I'm not really sure why, but I mean there aren't super nice programs around. There's just like some Xeroxed paper, or I guess photocopied paper, with the schedule on it. And if you even need that, you know, like I think half of this crowd has the open schedule that Dan Fry from Linux Link Tech Show designed. So I mean, it's all digital. It's kind of refreshing. I'm really enjoying the atmosphere. So today is Friday, the 13th actually, and so the festival has really yet to begin, so I could be completely wrong. Maybe tomorrow they're going to bring out the live bands and the animals and the parade and everything. But tomorrow is the fest proper. Today was a workshop day, and I know that there was the LPIC, the Linux Professional Institute certification, or whatever that thing is. I think there was a BSD cert class. There was something about Puppet, which I guess is like a desktop management system for large scale, installations of Linux, being able to push stuff out to each desktop, I guess. I'm not really sure. I didn't go. There's an intro to Puppet tomorrow, which I hope to attend. And then, of course, there was my talk, the multimedia presentation, how to do multimedia on Linux. And I feel like my talk went really well. It started out kind of concerned. I thought, well, it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of people interested in this sort of thing this year, but then a whole bunch of people showed up, and it was just a really nice small class. We found a room with a projector, and I say we found it because the room that they put us into didn't actually have any power outlets that I could find. So we found a place with power and sat down and just kind of went through Caden Live as the starting place, and then we took footage out of Caden Live. Well, we edited footage in Caden Live, then we took it out of Caden Live and edited, or it did some compositing in Blender. I forgot to set the frame size, so it didn't work exactly how it should have worked, but I mean it worked. It was just not placed where it should have been placed on the screen, but that's okay. Blender took that element out of Blender and back into Caden Live, composited it there, or finished the compositing there, and then took the sound out of Caden Live, went out to Qtractor, did a little bit of sound stuff, and then came back into Caden Live. And actually, there was another stop along the way where we edited some ums and smacking of lips and annoying things that people do in interviews. We edited those out in Audacity and brought that back into Caden Live. Actually, we didn't have to bring it back into it because Caden Live just updates it automatically. It's quite nice. So, a good little presentation. It went, I think, 1 hour, maybe an hour and a half less than, I guess, originally planned, but I think that was a really good thing because I gather that even though on the schedule it says, hey, it's 6 hours of multimedia, isn't that exciting? After about 4 hours of it, you're pretty ready to to take a, to make it stop. So we had a lunch break in there, obviously, but I think we had just enough time. We filled up exactly how much content we needed to fill, and it was really good. I get a good feeling about the presentation, so I was happy about that. And in this episode, I want to talk a little bit about something that I actually forgot to mention in that presentation, which is, or I mentioned it, but then I forgot to follow through, and that is the QJAC control patch bay feature, which is really, really nice. But first, let's do the traditional listener feedback. So a couple of people emailed me lately. There was Steve from Manchester, and I don't believe I'd met him before, so that was kind of cool to get an email from a new person, you know, a listener that I did not know existed previously. Steve said that he really enjoyed the LVM/LUKS Lux encryption talk that I did, I guess, last episode, which of course I was just basically stealing from Jesse James, so no credit where credit is not due. So, but he enjoyed it anyway, and he said that it was kind of cool because he had just finished doing an install rather of Arch Linux, a bootable Arch Linux system on an encrypted Lux encrypted thumb drive, which sounds really cool, and you can check that out at tweedtux.blogspot.com. I'll have the link in the show notes, of course. So that's really neat. I think that sounds really cool. I mean, I don't even know of other OSs doing that sort of thing. You know, a bootable device fully encrypted, it just sounds amazing to me. You know, I mean, if you really think about it. He also says that how I was mentioning, if you'll recall, I was mentioning and sort of raving about how integrated the encrypted volume was when you plug it into your Linux box. And it comes up in KDE and says, hey, I'm encrypted, and you can put in the password, and it decrypts it for you, opens it up in Dolphin, and it's all very transparent and smooth. He says that Thunar in XFCE does the same thing, which, of course, is no surprise. I figured that other desktops would have thought to do that as well, so it's good to get confirmation. I really don't know of another operating system that does that sort of thing exactly either. I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty sure there's no way to do that natively in the OS, the other OS that I'm familiar with anyway. I mean, there's TrueCrypt, which makes it pretty easy. I mean, it makes it easier, and that's nice. But if you think about how common thumb drives are now, not to have that feature in a desktop environment, it's definitely discouraging people from encrypting their thumb drives because, well, there's no reason to even think to do such a thing. And it's really kind of crippling them in a way, because even if they wanted to, it's not very integrated. And if they're on someone else's computer, then they would need the TrueCrypt installed on that computer. So it doesn't really seem like other OSs are doing anything for that right now, which is neat, I think. That's kind of cool that Linux and probably BSD, I imagine, you know, those desktop environments, that they've got that taken care of, and that's really, really cool to me. Another email came in from Babagao, I think I'm saying that name correctly, from Greece. You might remember him from maybe last season or the season before, I don't really remember, but he'd emailed a while ago just to kind of say hi. Now he emailed to say hi again, check back in. He's a musician, he's in Greece, he was saying that he might look into getting a practice space where he could record music with his band, and the recording would be done on GNU Linux, which sounds amazing to me. And I hope he follows through with it, and I hope he sends updates, because it sounds like a really great project. Obviously, anytime someone is putting GNU Linux into production like that, just only good can come of that, you know? I mean, they learn more about music programs. We all learn more about what Linux can and cannot do well, and where it needs polish. So, I mean, it's great to hear someone setting it up and really using it for serious stuff. So, Babagao, thank you for the update, and keep us updated on the music production. It's a very exciting project. I think that's everyone pretty much who emailed me. So let's get into this patch bay thing. But first, let's play some Segway music. Okay, so QJAC control, it's a great GUI front end to JAC. To a lot of people, it is JAC. That's the one that they get with the, you know, the Ubuntu Studios and the Dynabolics and all the pre-built multimedia distros ship with QJAC control. It's by the same guy who did Q-Tractor, as it turns out. The guy is phenomenally prolific. Between Q-Jack Control, Q-Tractor, and Q-Synth, the guy is, for me at least, I mean, he's music. He is music on Linux, you know? I mean, those are the linchpins, for me, again, of audio on Linux. And Q-Jack Control especially is just, it's just really, really slick. And Pat, if you heard I think it might have been either the most recent or the one before the Linux Link Tech Show, Pat was on a patented Pat rant about Pulse. And he was kind of saying that Pulse really wasn't working very well for him. And he said that before. He has said that many times before, if I recall correctly. And one of the things that he said a long time ago was that he really thought and couldn't understand why Q-Jack Control was not, or Jack in general really, was not the audio system for Linux. And I have to say, I really see his point. I mean, I understand that Pulse has some very specific, specialized features that Jack simply does not have, like streaming audio, stuff like that, or whatever you would call it, sending audio to remote devices and locations to play back, just like SSHX forwarding does for your graphics. I realize that, but in terms of Jack and its flexibility, and especially Q-Jack Control, and the ease with which you can do so many cool audio tricks, really is amazing. And one thing that Pat said was that once you get the hang of it, like once you learn Q-Jack Control, or Jack, I guess, in general, once you learn it, it becomes very intuitive. And that's a very funny thing to say. When I first heard him say that, I thought, wow, that's really sort of backwards logic almost, you know. Yeah, once you learn it, it becomes intuitive. But then I really thought about it, and I realized he was completely right. Like, once you learn the idea of how Jack works, and some of the lingo, some of the terminology that it uses, then you suddenly, you know, you find yourself opening up Q-Jack Control and messing around with things that you had no idea what to do with them before, and it all makes sense. And then you're like, well, wait a minute, I got this new device, but I can figure this out. And it becomes intuitive. You can actually start trying new things. You can try different setups. You can get new gear and set it up and have it work right out of the box, basically. Or, you know, I mean, as out of the box as having to configure it a little bit can be. So I really like Q-Jack Control, the bottom line. And if you don't have it installed and you're doing audio, then you would almost certainly want it installed. When you launch Q-Jack Control, you get like a little control panel. And it looks like a little rack-mountable device or something. You know, it's got this little screen on it with a little fake light reflection off in the corner. It's really nice. It's a slick-looking application for what it is. It's just a clock, a timecode clock. Not really that big of a deal, apparently. But some of the connection and the audio routing things that it can do will blow your mind, as we're about to discover. So the first thing to do after you launch Q-Jack Control, if you don't have it on, if you don't have it set to turn on automatically after launch, is to start it. And so that would be the start button in Q-Jack Control. As long as you're on a kernel that is above 2.6.38.4, you should really find yourself experiencing low latency almost just already, just now. Once you start Q-Jack, suddenly you're experiencing low latency. One caveat to that is that Q-Jack Control needs permission, and Jack itself, Jack D, needs permission on your system to run as a real-time, with real-time priority. Meaning that it needs to have a nice value of something negative. You know, it doesn't, you don't want this program to be nice. You want this to be, you want it to use up as many CPU cycles or whatever as possible. So you need to figure out on your distribution how that is done. And on Slackware, it's done with a little wrapper application called setr_limits. And you go into this setr_limits.conf, which is in /etc, and you add an @audio. You know, for the audio group, you want this program, so /usr/bin/jackd, for instance, to run with RT priority. I think the default value that everyone seems to plug in is 80 or something. The nice value I've seen is -1, works for me. And then I think there's one more value that you can put in, which is something like 10 or 100,000 milliseconds or something like that. I forget exactly what that final one is. But if you do an internet search for it, or you just look on slackermedia.info, you'll find all the specifics about that. Once you allow it to be a real-time process like that, then there's really no need to go out and hunt for a low-latency kernel or a special multimedia kernel, at least for a lot of users. I mean, I guess if you're doing a lot of live performance and you need absolute real-time performance, then yeah, you might need to go compile your own kernel or find one from your distribution that specializes in being a real-time kernel or whatever. But I have found such marvelous results with 2.6.38.4 and above. I've tried 2.6.38.4, 2.9.3.5, I think, or something, and then 3.1 are one of the release candidates for 3.1, and now I'm running on 3.2, and I just have not had an issue at all. Zero issues. I throw effects on my tracks. I have all kinds of audio playing at the same time in QTractor, and it does fine. I would say that the days of even really thinking that much about the whole issue of low latency, I think those days are over for most people. So there you go. That's how all of that works, I guess. The way that you route sound in QJack control is you would click on, now that it has started, you would click on the connect button, and connect brings up a connections window. And the idea here is that in a way, this is a patch bay. And if you've ever seen a networking patch bay, then the concept here is the same, except it's for sound instead. And if you've ever plugged in an earphone into your computer, then you've used a patch bay, essentially, because you're plugging those earphones into your ears, and then you're plugging the earphone jack into the microphone or the earphone port of your laptop or your computer or whatever. That's the idea. So QJack is that for you. On the left side of the QJack connections window is a panel that they call readable clients or output ports. Now, this always fools me because you have to, and this is the way I think of it, we're sitting outside of our computer, right? We are in front of our computer. We see the ports from our perspective. Jack lives inside of your computer. Again, this is how I think about it because it really helps me make sense of it. So everything to Jack kind of looks like the reverse. So your microphone input port on your laptop, well, to Jack, that's an output port. Why? Well, because Jack is listening to your... Can't you just picture a little guy named Jack and he's listening? Well, he's listening to your microphone from the inside of your computer. So sound is coming out, as it were, of that microphone port. And Jack can take that sound with a virtual cable and string it over to some other thing. So to him, that other thing... I keep saying him now that I've made that stupid analogy. To Jack, what it's going to plug that audio into is an input port. So microphone would be an output port for Jack, and for instance, QTractor would be an input port. So it's a little bit reversed than what we think of, but if you think of it in those terms, it really does make sense. So I'm going to start QTractor now because I want some more ports to show up. So here I've got QTractor started now. Now if I go back to QJack controls window, now I've gained more what they're calling outputs. So I've got a system, and that's got a capture 1 and capture 2. So that's my microphone on my laptop. That's the microphone. I've got QTractor as well. And from there, I see a master out 1 and a master out 2. And that is exactly that's what it's labeled as. That's the master output on QTractor. On the other side, the input, the writable clients or the input ports, I've got QTractor again. This time I've got a master input or master in 1 and master in 2, and I've got the system giving me a playback 1 and playback 2. So playback 1, playback 2 would be my computer's speakers, and QTractor master in 1 and 2 would be the input ports for QTractor. So I'm going to make sure that my microphone is not connected to my master in on QTractor right now, because I don't want to get feedback. One more thing I'm going to plug in, and that is this little Akai LPK25 keyboard that I've got. It's a little USB controller, really, really small, not terribly great in terms of touch sensitivity and stuff like that. I'm not recommending it necessarily. I'm not recommending it. The size is perfect for me, unless I wanted to actually play something because the keys are so darn small, but still, it's a nice little controller. It's USB controlled, and it does work out of the box with Linux, from what I've understood, most of them do. So if I go over to my Alpha tab in QJack Controls connection window, I see 14, port 14, or channel 14 rather, MIDI through. Okay, MIDI through is not something that we really have to worry about. I don't know how to use MIDI through on a computer exactly. I've never had the occasion to do that. But traditionally speaking, MIDI, like synthesizers, would have a MIDI in and a MIDI through and maybe a MIDI out. So if you wanted to send something from your sequencer to a synth, but then not have that synth respond, that particular synth respond to that sequence, then you could plug that into the through and then back out to the next synthesizer's input. And so it was basically a pass-through port, but I've never used that on the computer. I used it on a synth, I think, a long time ago, but I don't really remember anything about it. So I've got MIDI through, I've got LPK25, that's my Akai keyboard, and then I've got Q-Tractor itself. Well, in this case, the output, or the readable client would be my Akai. So that's the thing that I would want to connect to something inside of Q-Tractor. And so on my right-hand panel, again, I see a through port. I see the LPK25 again. I obviously don't want to connect it to itself. And I see Q-Tractor, which is the master MIDI input for Q-Tractor. So I'll click on that, click the connect button, and now you see a little virtual cable strung from the USB controller representation in the connections window, and the cable goes over to the Q-Tractor input. So now if I started a software synthesizer in Q-Tractor and started tapping the keys of my keyboard, I would hear sound. So that's how you control the software synths in Q-Tractor via USB keyboard. It makes sense. It's kind of all very obvious, right? Q-Tractor, we want our master out to go to playback. This is back in the audio tab. Our master out should be strung to the playback, and it is by default. And the reason for that should be pretty obvious. Everything that we are sending out of Q-Tractor, well, we want them to be routed into our laptop speakers so that the sound waves are then coming out of those speakers so that we can hear them. So all of that's pretty logical. And just getting to this point, there have been like 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 clicks to kind of get all of these things strung together. If you had to do that every time you wanted to make music, there would be that sort of lead time, right? You know, you're like, oh my gosh, I really want to play some music right now. And you'd sit down and you'd plug in your little keyboard, you'd start Q-Tractor, and then you'd unplug all the mic inputs from the master input because you don't want the feedback. You'd make sure that the output is put into playback. You'd click over to ALSA and string your LPK25 to your Q-Tractor, and then you could start. And that's not something that you should have to do every time. In addition to that, on a tower, like on my computer at work in my office, there's like when I start QJack control and I look at the connections window, there's like 8 different output ports on the left because there are so many sound devices inside of that computer. Like there's the NVIDIA or whatever, like the embedded, you know, I don't know, some. So I guess it must be the digital output, I guess. And then there's the normal output, and then there's a bunch of, like, surround sound options that I will never use in my whole life. So it gets kind of confusing in addition. And of course, it's not something simple like, oh, your computer speakers that you have plugged into your headphone port, oh, that's playback 1 and 2. No, it's not that. It's like 3 and 4 or something random, seemingly random like that. So being able to preset this into patch bay definitions is really, really handy. And this is, I think, what Pipeman Music was telling me about on the HPR New Year's episode, how you can kind of give custom names and custom patch bay profiles to certain setups. And this is quite nice. So here's how to do that. Now, no matter what, before I do this, I do the connection window just so that I can get it all straight in my head, because this patch bay thing is a little bit manual. So we're going to go over to QJack Control, and just next to the connect button, there's a patch bay button. Patch bay opens up. It looks really, really similar to the connections window. It's got the output ports on the left and the input sockets on the right. So same setup. You click the new button to create a new patch bay preset. And this is where you will complete this. I swear the programmer, God bless him, must have thrown this in just to confuse people. This is like him messing with us. A window pops open and says, create patch bay definition as a snapshot of all actual client connections. What could that possibly mean? Other than, yeah, that's exactly what I want to do, right? That sounds exactly like we want to do. We've just spent time reverse engineering our little computer's sound system with all of its 18 inputs and outputs and figuring out which MIDI driver to use, all this other stuff. You spend all that time, you hit new, and it offers to take a snapshot, and you're like, yeah, that's exactly what I want. Surprise, no, it's not. You have to answer no to this. I have no clue why. I don't know what that is supposed to be. I don't understand what that's asking, but it doesn't work. So you say no. or it doesn't do what we think it would do. So you say no to that, and now you are facing a new untitled and completely empty patch bay preset window. But don't panic, it's easy. First thing you do on the output side, so that's the left side, hit the add button, and that brings up a new window. It asks you to give whatever you're about to create an alias or a name. And so what we will create right here, let's do the Qtractor master out. So I'll do Qtract out 1. The type, I will define that as a audio output, and then it asks me for the client. So in this, I only have two choices in this case, the system or Qtractor. So I'll select Qtractor, and then it asks me which plug I want to associate with this definition. And in this case, I'll use master out underscore 1. And again, if you click the drop-down menu, there's only, in my case right now, only two choices. If you're on another computer, well, there would still only be two choices because Qtractor has two outputs. So you click the add plug, it adds it to the little list of output sockets, and click OK. Now, in your output window now on the left, you've got Qtractor out 1, and inside of that is a master out underscore 1. Well, do the same thing for Qtractor out 2. It's an audio connection. The client that we want to use a plug from is Qtractor. The plug that we want to use is master out 2. Add the plug and say OK. And now I've got yet another definition, Qtract out 2. And inside of that is master out 2. Things are going great so far. Trust me, this is exactly where we want to be. Doesn't seem exciting yet, but it will be. Now let's add that MIDI connection. So I'll click add again, and this time I'll put the Akai, I guess, 1. The type is going to be ALSA, because that's what I'm using as my MIDI driver. The client that I want to use is the LPK25. That's the name of my keyboard. I know because it says right under the brand LPK25. And then the plug that I want to assign that to is, in this case, MIDI 1. And I'll add that plug and say OK. And now in my output sockets on the left of my patch bay, I have Akai 1, inside of which is LPK25 MIDI 1. Right now, those are all the connections. Well, I would, probably in real life, I would also make a microphone one as well, but these are all the patch bay ones that these are what I care about right now. So that's my master output from Qtractor, master output from Qtractor, and a MIDI output from my keyboard. Now we want to send those things to places. So on the right-hand side of the patch bay, where it says input sockets, I would then click the add button. And first thing would be, of course, would be the speaker. I'll call it speaker 1. It's going to be an audio device, obviously. It's going to be the client that it's using is system, not Qtractor. This is the system, the speakers on your laptop or your tower, whatever. The plug that you want to assign that to, or you want to assign to it, is playback underscore 1. We'll add that plug. We'll say OK. And now, sure enough, on the right-hand side, input sockets, I've got speaker 1 being named playback 1. And I could do the same thing for playback 2. And then finally, one more would be the Qtractor MIDI input. And this is obviously pretty important because I need something to accept the MIDI signals from my keyboard. So the type is going to be ALSA. The client that I'm using is Qtractor, not LPK25. I've already got the LPK25 defined on the left side as an output device. This is an input thing, and the place that those MIDI signals, I want them to go, is into Qtractor. I'll choose that as my master plug, and I'll say OK to that, and now I've got that defined. Now, in real life, I also know that I would want to set up a connection or a destination port for instance, QSynth, which is external of Qtractor. So I would want to be able to send signals straight to QSynth if I need to. I would want to set up one for AmSynth, because that's another external one that I sometimes use. So, I mean, you can always add to this later as you go along, too. You don't have to, it's not like do it now or never kind of thing, but that's what I would do in real life. But I'm not going to do that because I don't have them launched. They're not available to me right now, and you probably just don't want to hear me go through every possible destination that could ever be. So now I've got all of these things set up. I've got them created. And then it's just repeating what you did in the connection window, and that is to click on the Qtractor out and send it to speaker 1 and hit the connect button. Qtractor out 2 to speaker 2 connect. Akai 1 to QTractor MIDI connect, and you see the little virtual cables being strung from one output device to one input device, whatever. And then you can click Save, and you can name this preset something logical and save it somewhere logical. And from then on, when you load QJack Control, you can load that patch bay configuration into QJack Control, and all of your devices, your keyboard, your microphone, the input and the output of QTractor, all of that will suddenly be configured auto-magically for you. But wait, it gets better. You can even make it more transparent than that by going into the setup for QJack Control. Go over to the Options tab, and down where it says Connections, Activate Patch Bay Persistence, you can put a check mark in that box, and then you can define which patch bay preset QJack should load automatically when it is when you start QJack. So now all your workflow is this: start QJack Control, start QTractor, done. It's really, really nice. It's a very handy trick to know about if you want to start using QJack Control, or if you already use it and you don't know about this trick, then now you do, and you should just take an evening. And it probably won't even take a full evening, so you could probably do this and have like a cup of coffee or something. Sit down, spend some time with your computer, figure out all the different outputs and inputs that you've got in Jack, figure out where you want them to go, and make yourself a preset and save it. It saves you so much time later on. So really nice feature, and it's funny because it's not really, I think it's a little bit mysterious, you know. It's called a patch bay. That to me says a lot of things, and this is exactly what I would expect it to do, but that stupid option about do you want me to create a snapshot of all your connections, I used to say yes to that, and I couldn't figure out why nothing was happening. Turns out, just for whatever reason, you have to say no to that. I don't know what it's asking, but whatever it's asking, the answer is no. Very, very cool patch bay feature of QJack Control. I wanted to get it out there a little bit further, you know, give it some airtime, because I just don't feel like a whole lot of people know about it. Turns out that this came because I was writing the QTractor manual over the past month or so, and I knew that Patch Bay was supposed to do something. I just could not figure out how to get it to work, so I went into Open Source Musician IRC channel, of course, asked a quick question about it, and Guitar Man just kind of referred me to this blog post from Rui Nuno Capella, who is the programmer, the guy who wrote QJack Control and QTractor and QSynth, and he's got this great blog post about it. I think it's literally rncbc.com/node/76 or something like that. It's pretty easy to remember, actually, but I'll link to it. But it's a great blog post. It has lots of screenshots and stuff like that, so if you can't follow what I was just doing over audio, you can refer to that for the visuals. But And that, actually, blog post was in turn a translation of, or a reiteration of someone's post to the mailing list. So it's like, this is one of those tricks that, I guess, I mean, no one had documented it yet, I guess. Or maybe he had, but he hadn't explained it in terms that, I guess, the normal musician could understand or something. And this mailing list guy spelled it out, and so then Rui took that version of how to do it and put it on his blog, and then Guitar Man referred me to that blog, and now I'm telling you about it. And that's how these kinds of tricks become more ubiquitous. We just keep repeating it to other people, and then suddenly everyone knows about the patch bay feature of QJack Control. I wrote a chapter on this for the QTractor manual, but Rui didn't really want it in the QTractor manual, so I took it out. But I put it in, I stole it for Slacker Media. So the next version of Slacker Media, which is imminent, is going to have a chapter called The Patch Bay That Jack Built, which I find immensely a clever title, and it will have all this information in it, although I didn't really bother with the whole screenshots and stuff. I don't think it's actually necessary. It's pretty clear, I think, as to what to do. So no matter how you need to look for this feature or information on the feature, you've got it now. Audio from me, great blog post with pictures from Rui Nuno Capella, and soon in a Slacker Media edition. I guess it'd be the second or third edition of Slacker Media, which, you know, will come soon enough. I'm kind of eyeing the old Slackware changelogs to make sure I don't release too soon, so we'll see what happens there. Okay, that's all I've got for QJack Control. Well, it sounds like it's time for a coffee break, and luckily I've got a coffee machine right here in my hotel room, so I'm going to brew myself a cup and get that started, and then we'll come back and finish up the show. Okay, so I've got my coffee here. Hopefully you've got yours. There's not a whole lot more to say. I'm going to probably try to get this episode out pretty quickly here and then start turning my attention back toward the Indiana Linux Fest and, you know, recognizing the fact that I'm actually here and probably should be taking advantage of it, not recording a episode in my hotel room. So, yeah, there's not a whole lot else to say other than something that's been on my list of things to mention for quite some time. I feel like I've mentioned it, but I don't think that they've ever made the cut. So, either way, linuxintheshell.org, that's Dan Washko's new side project. It's his as another podcast from him. It goes over Linux in the shell. I mean, what more is there to say about it? There is a screencast, an audiocast, and a what he is calling a text cast. So you not only get great show notes, you get great audio, and you get screencasts of a lot of what he's talking about. It's pretty slick. He goes over all kinds of cool and interesting things. I was amazed at how informative. Just, I think it was the one on, like, cat or something like that. You know, it was just so informative, and I just learned so many new tricks in that screencast. So really, just it's a fantastic show. I highly recommend it. If you've not heard it yet, just go over to linuxintheshell.org. Really, really exciting, really cool little show. So that's Linux in the Shell. Also, last Saturday, April 7th, I think, Slackware changelog updated with something that I found just kind of mildly interesting. Wanted to kind of relay it to you just because, I don't know, it's almost a sign of the times or something. And it's the isolinux, initrd.img. This was rebuilt recently for, you know, whatever is going to become the next Slackware version, and the notes in the file in the changelog said that he's using the genuine GNU bash instead of BusyBox, ASH. This fixes installer failure caused by exported variables such as term failing to propagate to subshells. I'm still not sure what's causing that issue, perhaps a change in glibc? But using real bash might be better in the long run, as we won't need to avoid bashisms in the script. The original reason bash was avoided was to keep things small for installer floppies, and we're well past that era. So there you go. Pat Volterding himself saying we are now officially past the floppy disk era. Good to know, good to know. But really, I just thought that was kind of interesting that now the, you know, computing, even the backward compatibility concerns, which I don't think anyone would argue that Slackware should really be retaining, you know, the smaller image for that initrd to keep it compatible for floppy disks. I mean, come on, we truly are past that stage. I think even the older computers, it's a stretch to argue that no, we really should keep that in and stick with this smaller shell. So it's kind of interesting to see bash getting integrated into the very early stages of installing Slackware and not really having to worry about can we keep this thing under whatever it was, 1.44 megabytes or something crazy like that. So that was just kind of interesting to me. It's neither here nor there, I don't think. I mean, the end result for us users is going to be the same. We install Slackware. But it's just kind of, I just thought that was an interesting little note in the changelog. The changelog for Slackware is good reading. If you have not visited the changelog ever or frequently, you might want to consider it. Even if you don't like Slackware, I think it's really interesting just because you get to see, like, how a distribution is built, you know? I mean, you get to see every change, everything that gets updated, everything that kind of gets changed and why it gets changed. I mean, this one is an obvious example. So if you go to slackware.com and click on the changelog link over on the left, then you can look up the architecture that you want to see the changelog for. I have my browsers set for the 64-bit changelog as their, like, little, you know, when you launch your browser for the, you know, when you launch it to go onto the internet in a web browser, it presents you with something. You know, you might have your browser set to show you your history tabs or your history pages, or you might have it set to show you your bookmarks, or maybe it goes just opens a blank page. I just have it set to go straight to that Slackware changelog, and it's pretty interesting. I always end up seeing something of interest, even, you know, whether it's a security update for Mozilla or a big change to initrd, the image for the next installer, or whatever. It's just kind of an interesting thing to look into. And if you don't set it as your homepage, I won't be offended, but I do think that you could look at it at some point, because it really is interesting to kind of see, so that's how it's all put together. That's how this how these distributions come about. And it's kind of cool because, you know, to me, a distribution sort of had always, for a very long time, had been very mysterious. You know, it was like, well, what is a distribution? What do they do? I don't understand what they do. And in some cases, I'm still a little bit unsure about that. Like, I mean, Fedora and Debian and things that really do customize a lot of different things. That's one thing. But looking at Slackware in its simplicity, you're just like, wow, I get it now. The maintainer gathers a bunch of packages from all over the place and makes sure that they all work like they're supposed to work in such a way that the thing can be installed and the thing runs. And if you look at it that way, it's almost like, oh, heck, I could build my own distribution. Which, you know, if you're feeling that way, Linux from scratch, my friend, Linux from scratch. But before you do that, you might just want to look at the changelog of Slackware, and then you get to experience the Linux of from scratch secondhand. It's kind of safe. So, there you go. That's all I've got for you today. I'm going to get back to the festival now. This has been episode 14 of season 7, GNU World Order. My name is Klaatu. You can find me online on irc.freenode.net as notklaatu. You can find me on Jabber as, I think, notklaatu@jabber.org. You can find me via email. You can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org or klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org. Either one works. And you can find me online, of course, at gnuworldorder.info. And also, as usual, slackermedia.info. Check that out if you're interested in the multimedia side of things. So thank you very much for listening, and I will talk to you next time.